Today's program was brought to you by Fiji Water and Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
Ever heard of a popcorn-driven robot? This week on Meet and Three, we're bringing you stories about the intersection of food and tech.
We're interested in building swarms of many cheap, small robots and powering them and driving them forward with as little effort and as little energy as possible.
We cover tech by land.
Imagine if you could cut fresh microgreens onto your salad and eat it while the greens are still fresh and nutritious and delicious and alive. That dream is real.
We cover tech by sea.
We're building software-based business services to help shellfish growers manage and grow their business.
And we cover tech in the social media stratosphere.
So it's not really necessarily an indictment on food media or media consumption at all. It's how the robots decided they were going to weight human interaction.
Tune in and get techie this week on Meet and Three, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
These chefs are, they work 6-7 days a week, 14 hours a day. I mean, that guy was working 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, period. I mean, he's an amazingly disciplined chef. The quality of the food falters when they're not there. They are not necessarily happy. They are not making a lot of money. You know, you're 100% dedicated to this thing. You spend 100% of your time doing it. It's not making you happy, and it's not making you money. And these people are the top 1%.
That is Daniel Holtzman of the Meatball Shop collection of restaurants, our guest this week on Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses
to make some sense of this.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, here with
Caitlin
Friedman.
I'm just going to leave it at Caitlin.
Good morning, Caitlin.
Hi.
Can I just say, as you know, if I sound off, I had one of those dreams, and it ended maybe 2 minutes ago when we woke up and we're doing a morning recording.
Was it epic? Like an epic
dream? No, it was not an epic dream. I had a disturbing, upsetting dream.
No.
Where somebody like died suddenly, very violently, and I was really upset.
This doesn't sound good.
I saw it happen.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, don't tell people what your dream was, because they'll read a lot into it.
And it was disturbing. I'm shaken. You know the kind of dream I mean?
Yeah, totally.
It's kind of amazing we can have dreams like that, our brains can do that.
There was actually an article recently about this, exactly what your body is doing when you sleep, and part of that is breaking emotional things down through dream.
Well, I heard the most succinct definition of a dream on the X-Files years ago.
Okay.
I Googled it because it was so profound that I thought it can't possibly be something that a writer on the X-Files came up with.
And what was that?
A dream is the answer to a question that you don't know how to ask.
And you looked it up and?
I've never been able to find a source for it. I think whoever wrote that episode of The X-Files said that brilliant thing. That is the best explanation of a dream, what's going on with a dream.
Right.
Not like neurotransmitters and all this and how it physiologically happens, but what is going on with your thought process in a dream. I think that is so simply stated, succinct, and correct. So I don't know what that dream was trying to tell me. However, before we introduce Daniel Holtzman, our guest today. I do have to say, we lost some people in the industry in the last week. Madeline Kamen, the great teacher. I never met Madeline Kamen, but she passed away recently. Much more untimely was the death of Jonathan Gold, who to me, was maybe the best writer about food. You could call it that broadly. Mm-hmm. I would say as much about Los Angeles as about food, as much about life as about food. I mean, there were a lot of obituaries written that compared him to sort of like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and Diddy and all these people who wrote about Los Angeles. And I think that was very accurate. He was one of those people that, as much as I admired him, I could not read him very often because I then would be unable to write.
Mm. Like then you would hate yourself.
My own writing would seem inadequate. Anyway, he was only in his late 50s. He died of pancreatic cancer, which is a horrible way to go. A lot of us didn't even know he had been sick. It was a shocking, terrible loss. I'd say two things selfishly about the loss of Jonathan Gold. Because, you know, these moments happen and you go, well, what do we make of this?
Mm-hmm.
First of all, between the loss of him and the loss of Tony Bourdain, people who do what I do, even as broadly as you want to describe that, write about the industry, chefs, food, we got to really step it up. I mean, these were two just massive losses to the community, but also to how the community is portrayed. And they're irreplaceable, really. So, and I'm not trying to imply that any of us could replace them, but I think if anybody wants to make sense of it, people who do podcasts, television, writing, is to step it up, you know, increase your output and also increase your quality to do the best possible work you can. Jonathan Gold's writing, go look up, there have been a lot of articles since he died, you know, online, websites being capable of what they are that, you know, link to like some of his greatest hits. Go read some of that stuff. It is inspiring. It is truly, it's just full of life. The other thing for me personally, as I've been thinking of it the last few days, and this is a purely selfish thought, I'm sure I could have very easily met Jonathan Gold. And I didn't. And I really regret that. So I'm going to just say that if you're listening to this show, if there's somebody you admire who you think there's a reasonable chance that they would say yes, and you're not going to be sort of a crazy, you know, Kathy Bates in Misery type fan about it, meet that person. I really regret that I didn't make a point of meeting Jonathan Gold, even if it was just for a coffee. People loved him. I would have loved to have known him. I think I always assumed we would probably just eventually at some point cross paths or be on a panel together or something. So that's what I have to say. But anyone who's listening who knew him, my condolences. Anybody who's in Los Angeles and people who are in Los Angeles will know what I mean by this. My condolences to all of you. The number of people who have just said LA will not be the same is stunning. And I really just feel for that city and obviously for his wife, Lori, and for their children. It's just heartbreaking. So moving along to this week's show, Daniel Holtzman, who I'm sure you've never met, Kate.
I've never met him.
Daniel, I had never met him until we did this interview. And I have to say, this is one of those interviews. Daniel's story is not particularly epic in scope, like, say, Hoonie Kim, who we had on the show. It mostly plays out in New York and California. It seems like a fairly traditional chef story. And then all of a sudden, it takes this wild turn. And I want to thank Daniel just for his honesty. This is an interview. And anyone listening who is a chef who gives interviews, listen to this interview, because people have become so guarded these days, and they want to be so controlling of their image and of their story. But Daniel is completely open. He describes some things that he's not particularly proud of. Mm-hmm. He's done incredibly well for himself. He figured out the path that made sense for himself. He's funny about it. And I believe not only is he no worse for wear for sharing, I think he is better for having shared an honest assessment, an honest portrayal of his life story. Nobody's perfect. And I love this interview. I was sitting there talking to him, and when it was over, you know, I felt like I'd made a new friend. I felt like I'd really gotten to know this person. I think that is the power of being open. And he really has that quality. And I don't even think I need to necessarily say more about it, because I think the interview very much speaks for itself. So with that, is that all right, Kate?
I think that's perfect.
Do I need to say any more setup?
I don't think so.
Do you want to make your train this morning?
That's not why I'm looking at you.
Let's say this was an imperfect or not very good intro. Would you?
I'd say this was the best intro.
You would say it was perfect.
This was better than the one that you erased and redid.
You'd just be looking at me with like admiring wifey eyes and going, "Boy, honey, you really stuck the landing on that one." Later. Right. Pew!
Come on, keep going. That was good though.
Okay. With that, this interview was conducted in the basement level of the meatball shop in Chelsea, the Chelsea location in New York City. So if you could imagine yourself walking down those stairs to find me and Daniel seated at a table, that's how we did it. Here you go. How many locations now for you guys? Is it a half dozen?
We have specifically. Not
like.
Half a real dozen. Actually, it's like a half a baker's dozen because we're opening in a month or so in D.C.
Oh, really? Where in D.C.?
On 14th Street, a block up from Le Diplomat. D.C. is it's a cool town. It's weird. As a kid, I went down there and I didn't really know anything about D.C. other than, you know, the like mall.
Uh-huh.
But not the...
Right.
The mall there is the political area with the buildings.
Right, it's not the mall the mall in...
like Paramus Mall. Where we could also put a meatball shop, arguably.
You could pretty much put one anywhere, it would seem to me. So before we get into sort of your backstory, with the number of locations you have, how do you allocate yourself?
Well, how do I allocate myself?
Where's your time spent?
So it's a difficult question to answer because it's evolved consistently from when we first started until today, and it's constantly changing. So... you know, about 18 months ago, we hired a CEO for the business.
Yeah.
And that made a massive change over the last 18 months and in the last 6 months specifically, because most of my administrative duty has kind of
gone away.
And that has been amazing.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, for the first like year of having the business, I was, you know, 90% of the time in the kitchen, and Mike was 90% of the time in the front of the house, and then we were both 10% of the time kind of like dealing with the small administrative duty of running one restaurant.
Right.
With multiple restaurants, the administrative duties balloon.
Sure.
You know, and so...
What's your title?
I don't know. What's my title? What?
Whatever you want it to be.
Founder? I don't know. Chef? Founder?
Here's my question. When you appoint a CEO...
I have a business card.
When you guys appoint a CEO,
right,
what's the relationship between you and the CEO? Like, did you become...
He's my boss.
That's what I meant.
Oh, yeah,
that was
my
what
boss.
I was trying to gingerly approach.
He's my
you
boss.
You put yourself in this person's hands.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Okay. And that's great.
You like that.
Oh, yeah, that's the best thing. I mean, it was challenging for me in the beginning to kind of like... And I think for him as well to kind of, in a way, to figure out how exactly to, you know, communicate most effectively and how for me not to kind of like... You know, we have this history with this whole team of people. And so I'm used to just kind of like telling people what to do a little bit. And so being, you know, figuring out how to respectfully disagree or agree without having to tiptoe around any of the kind of like political nonsense, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But we get along very, very well. I mean, we're very like-minded people, you know. And having a boss makes it really, it's great. I haven't had a boss in a long time. It's very nice.
Do you think that's unusual in a chef, that you would enjoy that dynamic? I feel like a lot of chefs can't wait to be an owner and not answer to anybody or not have anybody above them on the
That's because they haven't done it yet. That's because they haven't, like, that's what happens is that, you know, you want to not have a boss and you want to be, you know, this autonomous, you know, and you want to prove to the world that, and then you realize, like, man.
Right.
It's really kind of challenging to have to be out there. And ultimately, chain store executive is not a job that I have any training for it. Like, you know, I found myself doing a job that if I had applied for that job at a different organization, I would probably have a really hard time getting it.
Yeah.
Maybe now I have a resume for it, but you know, we were learning as we went. And it felt like learning as you go with a couple of restaurants, you're kind of cowboying it and it makes sense.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, you feel like the responsibility. And then there's a great deal of discipline required. And I feel like chefs, you know, we all have like a great deal of discipline for Tetris or for the stuff that is easy and fun.
Yeah, Tetris.
I'm like disciplined as, you know, I can just.
No, but you're dating yourself.
Tetris.
Am I? I don't know. We shouldn't
what
say
should
Pong.
I play?
Like, we shouldn't say Pong.
Yeah, I like Pong too. Or Snake. Snake was the original phone game.
Pac-Man.
Snake was on the Razor.
Can I interrupt? Somebody just a minute ago opened the door. It looked like they had this really heavy thing of ice or something and wanted to come through.
The truth is that they can come through, but I think they're going to go around.
But
the
they can get around? Yeah, okay, fine.
Or they're just
they wouldn't bother me.
They're just going to stand by the door.
Stand by there for an hour.
Yeah.
Okay. So, all right, Daniel, take me back.
They'll complain to the CEO. It'll be great.
Tell me about your childhood and where cooking started. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up on 83rd Street and First Avenue.
Uh-huh.
I was born in Boonton, New Jersey.
Okay.
I've never been back. I don't know it well, but I think it has influenced my life. It's given me a certain humility.
That you're from there?
Yeah,
you were born there?
I don't know.
opposed to the Upper East Side.
But I grew up, my mom and my pop moved back to Manhattan when I was young, in my 3 months old or something.
Okay.
So I grew up on 83rd Street and First Avenue. My mom was a really like inquisitive, adventurous cook. She loved to cook and she would always buy cookbooks. She taught herself to cook.
Uh-huh.
She was kind of a product of that. Although my grandmother knew how to cook as well, I feel like a lot of my generation's grandmothers were the first generation after kind of like World War II when cooking fell out of, it was a product of like second wave feminism where cooking all of a sudden fell out of fancy with advertising and microwave dinners and all that.
But I'm going to make the assumption that your grandmother or grandmother's cooked?
My grandmother.
Maternal.
My mom's grandmother, yeah. My mom's mother.
Your mom's mom. Yeah. I'm going to make the assumption that that was some sort of ethnically based home cooking, not like when you said your mom was like an adventurous cook and had cookbooks. I'm going to make an assumption your grandmother wasn't that kind of a cook. That it was more sort of recipes that were in the family.
But
that she had a good palate and knew how to cook really well.
All I know is that my mother taught herself how to cook. She didn't learn to cook from my grandmother.
Okay.
And so
she was what? Like she would cook at like Julia. She was like Julia Child.
Greens, Deborah Madison.
Yeah, sure.
The New York, Craig Claiborne, New York Times cookbook.
Yeah.
Obviously The Joy of Cooking.
Yeah.
And then it branched out. I mean, if you go to her house, she has her apartment. She has a contemporary library of cookbooks that are constantly rotating in and out that are, very, she's
of the moment.
Yeah, of the moment.
So she'll cook food from different countries. She'll try new stuff.
Absolutely. And she loves reading cookbooks. She loves reading the stories. And so she used to cook at home. And she would sit me next to her on the counter and I would watch her cook. And I, apparently was interested when I was very young, dipping my hand in the frying pan to eat the spinach, supposedly. And then when I was maybe 13, my brother was 5 years older. My mom works in the evenings. And, so she got me a job at a restaurant as a delivery boy, just as a way to kind of like be social and around people.
So not because it was food related, but just as a job.
It was like the only job I could get.
Right.
I was delivering pizza from the pizzeria across the street.
Yeah.
And then down the, she got me this job so that I would be with people in the evenings. I was, I guess like the equivalent of keep me out of trouble and, keep me. And so I was delivering Mexican food and then vegan food from the Candle Cafe, which is still there.
Uh-huh.
And it's actually a testament to the healthful, veganism that Joy and Bart, who own the Kendall Cafe, couple, they look exactly the same. Like
that's
30
amazing.
Years later, they
I've never
look
eaten
exactly
there.
The
now
same.
I want to go eat there.
I ate there fairly recently, within the last couple months.
Is this too personal? If it is, I'll edit it out. But were your parents divorced, or
they were? Yeah, when I was maybe four years old.
Me too.
Like
same thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So young enough that it didn't really have any. I mean, if I went to a psychiatrist, I'm sure they could disagree.
Right. But you don't have. It wasn't like a traumatic event because you didn't have much.
No memory.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
And they were very, very positive and supporting. My father would come over on Monday nights and play poker and have dinner with us. And we would do the weekends there. And, you know, my mom could always say, like, you know, I'm going to call your father. And we quickly fell in line. So,
I had the exact dynamic.
So there was no like.
Enough said. Yeah. I got it.
So, but my father's visitation day always coincided with Dollar Whopper night at Burger King, which was a magical and amazing.
Really?
Yeah, you could eat like 6 Whoppers. That only happened for like 2 years. My father was my mother wouldn't. I mean, we had no TV, no air conditioner, no microwave. You know, hand mashed organic baby food. She was very hippie, and my father was like, you know, when they came out with the Hostess 3-packs of cupcakes instead of the 2-packs, it was like 50% more cupcake for the same money. We were, you know, I mean, we definitely.
It's so funny you just invoked Burger King, because I mean, this is your interview. But when my father told me, and my brother, who's a year younger than I am, that he was leaving. We didn't know what that meant. We didn't know what divorce was. You know, we were like 4 and 5 years old. So he said, I'm leaving. And I said, well, before you go, at the time, McDonald's had like a Neapolitan ice cream cone. It was delicious. A vanilla chocolate strawberry ice. And I said, well, okay, before you go, can you take us to McDonald's for one of those?
Yeah.
And he did. Like, we put our robes over our pajamas and went to McDonald's. We ate it on the hood of his car.
You're like, can you leave more often?
No. And then we came home, and then he, like, left. Yeah. Like, and moved out of the house.
That's great.
Then we figured it out. Anyway, so, but this is interesting to me, because you grew up on the Upper East Side, but you're describing a lot of very, you know, your mom was a sophisticated cook.
Yeah, we were
sophisticated
more proletariat
than
bougie.
But you guys were very, I don't want to say like had populist taste or something, but you guys weren't snobs, clearly.
No, I don't think
at
so.
Least about
but we
food.
Also grew up on First Avenue in a kind of a basement apartment. We didn't have a lot of cash.
Yeah.
So my father was a carpenter and a cabinet maker, and my mom was a secretary. So it's not like we had a lot of cash. We went out, and, you know, at that time, you went out to restaurants like once a year, twice a year, you know?
Right.
I mean, special occasion, maybe. Chinese food, you know, a few times a year.
So when you start doing this delivery job and you're sort of on the periphery of restaurants and fast food places, whatever, did you have an immediate sort of, did you gravitate toward it? Did you find the setting like appealing?
You know, so there were a couple of factors, right, involved in it. One was, yes, I was really attracted to the kind of like machismo freedom of working in a restaurant and, you know, making my own money. And, you know, I had to deal with my mom. I started paying rent when I was like 14 or something. I was like, you know, I'll pay you rent and you don't tell me where I spend the rest of my money. Like,
is that right?
Yeah. Like, I don't need any money from you. Like, we're going to have this.
And she was down with that?
You know, she played along. She played along.
Right. You had the illusion of independence.
Yeah, I had the illusion of independence. I did.
And she got your money.
Yeah, she did.
She won.
My mom is still a winner.
That's great.
And then, I don't know, I was attracted to the guys in the kitchen from really early on because of the respect that they got, you know, like fire and tattoos and, you know, people said, yes, sir, yes, chef, and that really was kind of sexy. And then I also, I started kind of working in the kitchen early on, and people would tell me, like, you're so young, you know, to work in the kitchen. And I remember always wanting to be like the youngest, best at something for whatever reason. That was like some obsession that I had.
I totally get
and
this.
I would get like really annoyed when, like, you know, this kid would be like in gymnastics class or like in martial arts class, and they would be like, oh, he's like the youngest best. And I was like, if I don't start early at something, if I'm not like the youngest at something, I'm never going to be able to be the best at something. And so I feel like I really like that idea that I was like, you know, people would tell me like, you know, oh, I identify with you working in a restaurant, and, you know, it's like a similar to the, what are the, you know, the, when people go to have a internship or whatever in France or something like that, or
like a, like what, not a stop. You mean the apprentice?
Yeah. Like, yeah, an, like, apprenticeship. Like, you know, an apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, so that was very, attractive. I got excited about that. So my best friend at the time was this woman named Natalie Le Magaresse.
Okay.
Le Magaresse.
And her father was a maitre d' at Le Bernardin. Mm. And he got me a job working at Le Bernardin when I was like 14 years old working in the kitchen.
Now, I had read this about you.
Yeah.
You were 14. Was that under wraps?
I didn't get paid. On my 16th birthday, Eric gave me a box of chocolates and a paycheck. He was like, aww, you can, you know, now I can pay you. I think that's what he said. Yeah. That was the extent of that conversation.
Right.
So I just worked there on, you know, after school on Wednesdays.
Yeah.
And like, I remember the first day I went in for an interview, and I like went in after high school, and I got out of high school. He told me, I guess I was supposed to be there at 3. I had no idea. I showed up at 3:30, and he was like, "You are lucky I was taking a haircut, because you are late and you would have been fired."
Eric said this to you.
He said, I was like, okay.
Right.
Like, but I was late too, so
right.
I give you a chance.
So yeah.
I was like, okay.
Yeah. Nothing like a Buddhist chef.
Yeah, I worked. Well, he wasn't Buddhist, I don't think, yet.
Oh, that's right.
He was a little more aggressive then. Maybe just at the very beginnings. I remember when he adopted Buddhism, he came into the kitchen because Chris used to call me a jack job. He's like the chef there, and he would call me a jack job, and he would scream at me. One day, Garrick was like, you know, we're adopting a new philosophy, and you can't call him a jack job anymore. And I remember the look on his face, like, but he is a jack job. This kid is such a twerp. That's so great. But
what was it like to be a kid going in? I mean, that's like going into a French kitchen here in the U.S., isn't it, basically?
The thing about it is I really had no idea what was going on. You know what I mean?
Did you even know what it
was? Like, I knew I got the
its place in the world?
I got the positive reinforcement of people outside telling me what it was.
Right.
But, you know,
you didn't know enough to be intimidated.
No,
by it.
And I didn't know anything about it. And I didn't, it's not like they let me, you know, I was the guy that my first job was bringing the fish from the refrigerator to the person that would get to cook it. I mean, and that's a thing because that was something that they did, was that to keep the fish cold, they keep it on the other side of the kitchen.
Yeah.
So normally in kitchens, like, you have the fish in the refrigerator right behind the stove. But the problem with that is you open the door every day, every minute.
Right. Ambient heat
and so
cold
they
getting
keep
out. Yeah.
The fish on the other side. And there's a person whose actually job it is to like get the orders, take the pieces of fish, arrange them, and bring them to person. And then I was like allowed to clean calamari for, you know, a long time, like
lucky
a year
you.
All I could do. I'm very good at that still.
Yeah.
And my dad made up a whole song about it. I was like the calamari kid.
What, he wrote a song about
it? Yeah, he did.
What, was it like country western?
It was like, it was the calamari kid, the yid that cleaned the squid. That was the basic, the whole song.
Okay, that's definitely
to a tune.
That's definitely not a Western.
Not a Western. Well, actually,
Blazing Saddles.
Big matter. So, and then Open Oysters. So, you know, it wasn't like I was in a position to screw anything up ever.
But you liked it.
I loved it. I loved the reinforcement from the outside. I loved the camaraderie of the kitchen, and in general, just being part of some, like, you know, team of like-minded individuals that are passionately driving towards and you know, these deadlines that are extreme. You know, today I feel like the deadlines of the kitchen are so fulfilling because they happen. They come up so quickly, and then you have a chance to execute over and over and over again.
Yeah.
We don't get that chance so much in life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's almost like a video game. It's like you get to do it over and do it over and do it over and do it over. And that feels really great.
Yeah, but it's even, to me, it's even less predictable. Like a video, when I think of a video game, I think about, you know, you're trying to clear all the various levels, right?
Yeah.
But they're always the same. You know what I mean? It's almost like a dream that like repeats itself. But to me, what you guys do, like a restaurant, every night, it's not the opponent. I don't mean to put it in adversarial terms, but every night it's interactive. Like it's a different.
I
know what I'm saying?
So.
Like the customers are different every night. The orders are different every night. The pace is different every night.
It is. Although there's,
so that to
I
me makes it even more. Voyeuristically to me, that would make it more challenging and more exciting.
I feel like when you work as there are different areas of obviously of a kitchen if you're working in a kitchen. But if you're working a station where your job is to, you know, basically get the information in and produce a product and send it out as consistently and, you know,
and it's finite set of products.
And in lockstep with the rest of the team. And you get to a point where there's that sense of flow where, you know, as a working person, if you've never experienced, if a person has never experienced that, it's kind of sad because it feels so great. It's like this euphoric moment where if you play an instrument and you stop having to translate from the music to your fingers, but it just happens autonomously.
Yeah. I mean, people have compared this to being in a band, as you know, you just talked about music. I've heard people compare the kitchen, you know, the silent community. You know,
I think of it like a pirate ship.
A pirate ship.
At war. Yeah, pirate ship at war, you know. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, you get to curse and at the end it's all forgiven. Although not anymore. Nowadays, what you say on the battlefield sticks with you.
Yes.
You got body cams.
Yes.
I want to put
it's body cams. It's a pirate ship with an HR department.
I want to put body cams on the kitchen. That's what we're going to do.
No, but people have compared
that's
it
where
to,
we're going, by the way.
But
we're going to body cams.
You think that's going to happen?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm going to be the driver.
I think we're all going to have body cams.
I can't
eventually.
Wait. Well, we do. We have them, and we just keep them in our back
that's
pocket.
That's true. Right. Yeah. But no, but I've heard people compare it to bands where, you know, a lot gets communicated with just a, like someone can look at you in a kitchen that's really
insane.
The
whole thing.
And you know what they need just from the look in their eye. Or, you know, Keller in the Thomas Keller restaurant group in the employee manual, I don't know if it's still in there, but they used to, there was this whole thing where he calls it the dance and it's about the synchronicity of the kitchen. And I mean, there are all these analogies that people use, but they all have to sort of do with a group of people functioning almost like an organism.
Do you get to that point when you're writing, when you stop thinking and it just happens?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Do you do that with a computer?
I can only write on a keyboard. I cannot write longhand.
Really? Because it doesn't go fast enough? Or?
I don't know. It's a rhythm thing. I think of it almost. Someone asked me. My old roommate used to be in a band.
Uh-huh.
And
is
I was
it
hanging,
the sound of the keys?
And I was. It's just the rhythm. It's tactile. It's the feeling of it. It's the rhythm of writing. I can't. You think I could explain it because I'm a writer. But one of the guys in the band that said to me one day, I came to watch a rehearsal, and he said, "Do you play an instrument?" And I said, just my laptop.
Yeah.
You know? But that's how I think of it. But I do get into a place. Like a writer, it's like a writer's high. Like when people talk about runner's high.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to have, once in a while I would write something, still, I'll write something I'm really excited about and I want to read it to someone. And someone said to me once, you know, Andrew, do you ever worry that it's a little arrogant that you're reading your own stuff to someone?
Yeah.
And I go, I don't even feel like I wrote it. You know, like I feel like it, something inhabited me. Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
And I looked down and like there was this two pages of stuff, you know? That happened. That's actually, for me, that's when the best work happens.
I write a lot. I write a column. I write like a couple of, and so I could do, and it's always excruciating. It never, ever happens.
Yeah.
That's never happened to me. And so
ever.
My goal is like, my dream is one day I would be able to, you know, find that place where I don't have to. And actually, I was listening to some podcasts where these people put these like 9-volt batteries in different places on their brain to, and it's like a thing that the army is using to kind of like, you know, I don't know, stimulate flow.
Okay.
So one day maybe I'm just going to like
Jason Bourne stuff.
Pick up the, you know.
What I'm describing happens once in a while.
Yeah.
It's not totally infrequent, but, I just love it when it happens. It's to me it's the dream. It's the ideal. It's usually, it's almost never during the workday. It has to be early, early in the morning, when I'm almost half asleep, or late at night. It's weird. I need to know.
No interruption.
And no possibility of interruption.
Do you turn off
like,
the internet?
Like I need to know the world is like asleep. You know, like my phone's not going to ring. I'm not. An email's
but
not going to
pop up. But
do
you turn off the internet, or do you keep it on?
On my best days, I'll turn off my Wi-Fi and I'll put my phone in another room. Yeah. Or if I'm at WeWork where I work, I have a WeWork desk, I'll have my phone in my bag. Yeah, and I'll turn off my Wi-Fi.
I feel like you could get sponsorship from WeWork. This is the third time you said WeWork. WeWork is such a great organization.
I know. I'm going to hit them up.
Yeah.
I'm going to
WeWork, I work, WeWork. They need a better slogan, like the ice cream.
Do they
one.
Have a slogan?
No, but they could. That's what I'm saying.
I think their name is their slogan. What happens after Laverne and Em?
Eric got me, helped me to get a full scholarship to the Culinary Institute of America from the James Stewart Foundation, which was absolutely amazing. He said, you know, you should go to the, he said you should go, his words were like, you know, you go to culinary school,
I'm not going to do the accent. I can do the accent really well.
You
I
can do him in particular?
Oh, yeah, all the French people in general. But
let's hear your Danielle.
No,
everyone,
people tell me.
I don't know if people, everyone has a Danielle.
I know, but people tell me it's like racist to use accents now. It's like a thing. It's like a new thing. And like if someone once told me that it's not racist if I do an accent of a white person, I was like, that's like so much worse. Like to like that I can only like do white people accents. It's just so terrible.
I for the longest time have wanted to get like every chef I know to do like I wanted to do like a half hour of just Danielle.
He I like that guy.
Danielle?
Yeah, I like
the best.
That guy a lot. So he was like, you know, you'll go to culinary school, you'll work for me for 10 years, and then I'm opening restaurants and you know, I'll make you the chef of one of the restaurants. That was like it was amazing.
So he really liked you.
I think he told me I was his spiritual son. It was really
Did
great.
He?
Yeah, I really burned that bridge, though, so it's not a happy ending. I burned a lot of bridges. It's always terrible. I mean, not an unhappy ending. You know, I don't think he's like, he thinks about me ever.
He's not like out to get you.
I don't think he's trying to hurt. But yeah, I mean, he might maybe a little bit.
Oh, wow.
No, I didn't do anything like
Can
terrible.
You tell, what happened?
Yeah, I just kind of like stopped. I think I was, well, I know exactly what happened. I, first of all, got into trouble at culinary school, and I didn't tell him. So then he got me an externship or helped me to get an externship for Jean-Louis Paladin. And I really wanted to work for that guy. But I hadn't told him that I had kind of like gotten into trouble at culinary school and gotten suspended, which wasn't awesome. And so I think that kind of like was the first.
He heard it from someone
strike.
Else.
He like heard it from, he's like, you know, how would you expect that I wouldn't learn this? And I was like.
And he had like, it's like the mob. He had recommended you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. I think at the end of the day, like he's beyond. It's not the worst thing in the world. You know, his reputation wasn't marred. It's not like they were, you know. But at the same time, it was like, you know, I certainly that was not that didn't exemplify a great character for me to have been kind of taken care of by this person, gotten this favor, and then not like
yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then I. Remember, he then got me a job working for. I stopped working in restaurants. I worked for some like TV company, which was a disaster.
Doing
and hysterical.
Food stuff?
No, like trying to be like an assistant. My brother's a big TV producer, and at the time he was working at Miramax. He got me a job at Miramax Films, and then he got me a job, and like I got a job at like this other film company, and it was a terrible disaster. I was just not set for office work, and at the time it was the first time I kind of like gained some weight, and all my clothing was really tight. I remember just having really tight clothing, being like this fat kid.
So you were
kid
just
really
like
tight.
This miserable.
But when you first gain weight, like it goes everywhere. So it was like my shoes were tight and my pants were tight and my shirts were tight. And it was just like very awkward. Yeah. And I was living in LA.
It's like turning into the Hulk, but in a
not a good way. Yeah. Not in a good way. Yeah. It was really terrible. And I've got great stories from that experience. I had a really amazing experience where I split my pants because of the tightness of them.
Yeah.
But for that, I'll go for another time, but it's very funny.
Okay.
Very
I look good. Forward to hearing it.
And so I called him up and I said, listen, I want to get back into the kitchen. And he got me a job working for Laurent Monrique, who's amazing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Can you tell people who that is?
Laurent Monrique is this, he still has a number of restaurants. He's out from San Francisco. He's a really passionate chef who is kind of one of that old guard of French chefs, along with Eric and Danielle. I guess Eric was a little bit behind Danielle, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like it was Jean-Louis Paladin kind of like brought Danielle over and then Eric. And, you know, Laurent and Eric are contemporaries. And
Can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Yeah.
We should probably say, this is my own myopia. For people who don't know, Jean-Louis Paladin...
Is a French guy.
Is a French guy. French guy. For an entire... Jean-Louis was at... He grew up in France. He came over here. He was the chef at the Watergate. Jean-Louis at the Watergate was the restaurant. And he came over, I think, in 79. And for any Americans of that generation, this guy was it. Thomas Keller used to save his money to go eat there once or twice a year. He had something like 4 different tasting menus that changed daily.
His book was like 20 years before its time.
Yeah, I mean, this guy was like God to a generation of chefs. He also loved American
food.
Food, yeah. Products. Like, he came over here and started using corn and crayfish and, like, he really
and
adapted.
Teaching farmers and fishermen, yes, how to actually get product, and he elevated the quality.
Yes.
He did what he kind of did for fine dining what James Beard did for, you know, I guess everyday food. Does that kind of make sense?
In the sense was one of the people who did that. Yeah.
And he celebrated, he was the first kind of like celebrated French chef to say, you know, I'm not using canned German white asparagus. I'm using local American asparagus because local American asparagus is great.
Yeah.
And that
and
was,
on top of all that, he was a party animal and a fun guy, and he looked like a mad scientist a little bit, and people loved him. And he died tragically young from lung cancer.
Yeah, he smoked two packs of Marlboro Reds.
He was a major smoker.
On the line, he was smoking
anyway,
cigarettes.
So for people who don't know, if you're a chef or a cook out there and you don't know, you should probably look at Wikipedia at least, because I don't know another chef that people talk about. Like, kind of the way some people today would talk about someone like Pierre Gagnaire.
Yeah.
Right? Like, just having it in his fingers almost. Like, just this genius, just touched by
God. I have
God.
All his notes from when he would do a menu change, he would write his notes.
Yeah.
And he wrote, and he spoke very, like, broken, you know, like, weird English.
Yeah.
And very passionate. And he wrote in the same exact voice that he spoke in, which was very funny.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, normally you don't sound exactly like you sound in real life
no,
when you're writing.
Almost never. Yeah.
Anyway, so Laurent Monrique, who was the chef of the Campton Place Hotel at the time, and then he kind of became the chef of Aqua Restaurant Group, and then now he's a chef of the Café de la Presse and a couple other kind of like French restaurants.
Aqua in San
there.
Francisco.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He. The truth is that, you know, he's one of the greatest cooks that, like, I've ever had the pleasure of working with. And he is his food, rustic French food, is absolutely amazing.
Uh-huh.
Like, if you ever see him grill over fire, it's like incredible to watch. He did something one time that was so amazingly cool, where we were cooking and we were cooking squab outside, and we built this grill where, you know, there were bricks lifting up the griddle over the coals or whatever, and the fat was dripping down and it was lighting on fire and like burnt, and it was burning the skin of the squab, I think.
Yeah.
It was burning the skin. And I was like, you know, trying to like spray water. And he was like, lower the grill. And I was like, you know, you idiot. Obviously. I mean, I think I might've even said that. Like, what are you thinking? Like, I know in France you don't have like thermodynamics or like science, but you can't put the thing closer to the fire. If it's burning, you put it further away. And he just kind of like shoved me out of the way and kicked the, bricks out of the way.
And the grate just dropped?
The grill dropped straight onto the coals. And because of that, it smothered the oxygen and the fire went out. And they cooked perfectly and crispy and like absolutely gorgeous. And he was like, you know, you're the idiot. You know.
Right.
Whatever. Like dilettante, pet, you know, like imbecile or whatever. And
it's amazing when you see someone who has... It's
knows
an
what
instant,
they're doing.
But it's an instant... At some level, I know that he was taught to cook, but the... I do think there are people who, you know, Chuck Close, the painter, I once heard this amazing quote from him where he said that he knew how the paint would land. It's an amazing comment. I feel like there are cooks and chefs who just, they know how the ingredients or how it's going to land. Like, they just, it's an instinct.
He was pretty great.
It's not all, it's like when you see tennis players and hit a shot and someone says, you can't teach that. Like, there's some guys, I think, operate at a level that you can't teach.
Every now and then I go out to dinner and I'm really jealous because I feel like they just really know. They're cooking at a level, doing things that I hadn't thought of or, you know, anyway.
There's writers I can't read David Foster Wallace because I won't write for 2 days.
Yeah.
It just messes me up. I mean, literally, I don't read him.
Well, that guy was a really great cook.
Yeah.
I really liked working with him.
So, here's a question
for
you.
And I still like him a lot.
You're describing a very French-focused, including really the CIA.
Oh, the whole time. After that, I worked at Laurent Gras and then Tracy Desjardins and then like all French people, all French four-star fancy food.
Where did you think you were? Like, did you have a...
Four-star French chef.
Did you have a bullseye in mind
as
to where your career was headed?
Four-star French chef.
That's what you wanted to do. Were you, like, keeping notes and
on,
like, your own
ideas
for dishes?
I've got my whole books and all that stuff. And,
did you have a restaurant you had in mind?
No. No.
But that's where you thought you were headed.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
And it was Laurent Garat that really, like, killed that for me.
How so?
Because he was so disciplined, and I, like, looked at and watched that, and I just thought, you know, I had this very strong impression that these chefs are, they work 6-7 days a week, 14 hours a day. I mean, that guy was working 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, period. I mean, he's an amazingly disciplined chef. And the quality of the food falters when they're not there,
yep,
for the most part. They are not necessarily happy.
Mm-hmm.
They are not making a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, you know, you're 100% dedicated to this thing. You spend 100% of your time doing it. It's not making you happy. And it's not making you money or any, or like giving you any, you know, like whatever for the future.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then I'm like, and these people are the top 1%.
Yeah. You're describing a codependent relationship.
And they're the top 1%.
Right.
So like, it's like trying to, so I'm like, I have a great deal of confidence, and I feel wholeheartedly like, okay, I can be the top 1%. I can be one of these. Maybe it's not even the top 1%. It's like the top 0.01%. I can be one of these. So like, even if I happen to be as amazing as I'd like to think I am, and I can be in the top 0.01% of all of the chefs in the world, I'm still going to wind up working my ass off, not making any money and being unhappy.
Yeah.
And that was a big issue for me, a real issue. And secondly, you know, I like having fun. A lot. I like laughing every single day. I come from like a Jewish family of, you know, where we communicate our emotions, you know, with like by busting each other's chops,
yeah,
and not, you know. And so the discipline of being silent and in the kitchen was not for me. You know, I went on a trip to Italy and I saw these cooks in t-shirts, and it felt like they were in a home kitchen and they were laughing and having a good time. And
you don't
mean
on vacation. You saw cooks, Italian cooks in an Italian restaurant.
No, the first time I was in Italy.
Yeah, I'm saying, yeah, but these were, yeah, working cooks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw that and I was like, and then.
That was a revelation for you?
That was a revelation for me, yeah.
How old, can I ask how old you were when you started to sort of realize, like when you
18,
pivoted?
18, 19.
That's it?
Maybe old.
You had worked these jobs 20? Before 20? That's amazing.
No, maybe I was older than that. I don't know. 20, yeah. Early 20s? 19, 20, 22, okay, right around, yeah, 20. Somewhere around there.
Wow. So you figured, yeah, out young that you wanted something different.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Maybe 20. Let me think about it. I worked for all these guys. Maybe I was 25, actually. 25, yeah. And then it was like, this is not for me. And
was that a hard thing to realize? Like, was it hard to let go? You know, you started off by telling me, you know, you wanted to be the youngest best at something, right? Like, that's a competitive notion, right? And you obviously were very ambitious about this particular thing. Was it a hard, I think sometimes it's hard to let go of a notion you had, even if that's the healthiest thing to do for yourself.
You know,
you
I think
put a lot of time
I
into this.
Yeah, but I got kind of fired from every job. I would get
Did
into
you really?
Trouble. Yeah, I got fired from almost every job I ever had. Or I would quit right before I was going to get fired. I never fit in because I was always cracking jokes and being like a little bit of a troublemaker.
Okay.
And
you got to be careful. You got a CEO now.
I know. That wouldn't be the first time I got fired from a restaurant I owned, let me tell you. That was the most depressing. Unfortunately,
Are you being serious?
Yeah, I'm just legally obligated never to speak about it.
Okay. You're talking about, you're working in like the best, yeah, kitchens around, right?
I just
but
didn't
you were
play well
like-
on teams. You know, I had a really shitty attitude in general. And
is it an authority thing?
It was an authority thing, but yeah, it wasn't like for the boss. It was like for the second in charge. You know what I mean?
Was it because you thought you were better,
yeah,
than,
better
you?
Than everybody, yeah, else? I had like a better than everybody else issue.
Yeah.
And
I have a lot
and
of
then
this is the reason, yeah, I'm a writer.
Yeah. Also, on top of having a better than everybody else issue, I also had like a, I didn't realize that, like,
yeah,
you know, there's, if you think you're better than people, it's either true or not, or, you know, that's really the truth. Like, there's sometimes when you're better at doing something than somebody else, and sometimes when they're better than you, and it's, you know, it's like, you know, it's like math. It's either true or not,
right,
for certain things. And if you are better than somebody at something, then everybody kind of notices it and can see it.
But, you know, and if you're not, everybody can notice it. And there's nothing like, the only thing worse than saying you're better than somebody when you're not is saying that you're better than somebody when you are. Like, you know what I mean?
No.
Like,
what do you mean by
like,
that?
If I say, like, I'm a better writer than you,
yeah.
I'm just kind of like an idiot, and you're like, you laugh at me. But if I am actually a better writer than you, and then I say I'm a better writer than you,
then you're just like,
then I'm like,
then you're just rubbing salt in the wound.
Yeah, it's like, I'm like,
right.
Being an idiot is better than being an arrogant asshole.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I worked for, you know, I had years of normal jobs before I was lucky enough to make a living just writing, right? And there was one job I had. I was at a PR firm, actually, and I just had no respect for the person who owned it. I lasted like 8 weeks. And I quit before
you got fired.
Yes.
That's
yes.
the trick.
I think I had been fired, but they'd given me like a week, and then I quit. That was pretty dumb. I've worked for great people, and I've worked for really awful people, but all the other jobs I kept for a long time because the people I worked for were brilliant.
Hmm.
You know, I don't want to say who it was, but I worked for one person for 4 years. And the guy had like emotional issues and temperamental, but I'll tell you, and I learned so much. It's stuff that I use all the time in business myself today. And I was willing to withstand the abuse for the knowledge. Does that make sense?
I couldn't work for
someone who I knew I was smarter than.
Definitely not.
I couldn't.
It's immature because at a certain point you realize like, just because you might be better at one technical aspect of the job or other, it doesn't mean there's not something you can learn from them.
Exactly.
And, you know, and you're not doing yourself or anybody else any good by letting anybody know that you're better than anybody.
It doesn't look good to just move around all the time.
There's just so many reasons.
Yeah.
Although I will say this, as a cook, you know, I really had 1 year time limit on every job I ever had. And I never was a sous chef. So I always worked. And I do think that, you know, the reality is that when I see a piece of halibut or a bunch of asparagus, you know, I actually have 10 or 12 different chefs that I've worked for that cooked that fish or that asparagus differently.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that exposure really has benefited me a great deal.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen a lot of different ways to do a lot of different stuff.
Right.
And Eric did tell me that and it makes perfect sense. I see it today with folks that work in the restaurants, which is, you have like, you know, whatever it is, like a very steep 3 month learning curve. And then, you know, 6 months of really like getting to perfect your job and learning the stations and really getting along in the kitchen. And then, you know, there's a real rate of diminishing return that starts to happen. And so like if you spend a year in a kitchen, if you're not planning on staying there for a long time, you should quit that job and go work somewhere else.
We've talked about this with other guests on the show. That used to be this sort of the assumption was you would take a job for about a year.
I think now
it's different because it's a cook's market now and there's such a demand for cooks. People can get away with moving around. I think it used to be if you left in under a year, you might get blacklisted.
You were blacklisted.
Yeah, but now that's there's too much need for cooks.
There is I think there's still the fancier restaurants are still the fancier restaurants.
There's still that
I think there's probably still that mafia mentality
like you can the word can get around.
Yeah, I mean they're checking references if you go get a job at 11 Madison Park and if you were a dickhead I think like, you know, they're probably gonna.
Probably so. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a penny bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium, to galas in the renovated Palm House, and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe, overlooking Lily Pool Terrace.
Chef Rob Newton and Chef de Cuisine Morgan Jarrett offer warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
Welcome back. We will return you to our interview with Chef Daniel Holtzman in just a moment. Caitlin.
Yes.
I learned something last week. A number of listeners got in touch with me. Mm-hmm. When I say number, I mean like two. I want to be honest, you know. I don't want to be like, people are saying, you know, like that guy on Pennsylvania Avenue. People are saying.
Oh, my God.
It was two.
Okay.
That it is hard. Mm-hmm. Two is a number, though.
Mm-hmm.
It is hard. Harder than I realized to leave a review for this show. Did you know that? On iTunes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's not like that immediate. So I'm going to tell people just quickly how to do that. In case you've wanted to leave a review or even a rating and you couldn't figure out what to do,
mm-hmm.
here's what you do. I'm actually doing this as we talk here. You go to your podcast app. You open it up. At the bottom, on the very left, it says Listen Now. Next to that, it says Library. You click on Library. And then at the top of the Library page, you click Shows. Well, after you click Shows, you find the name of the show you want to rate or review. In this case, you select Andrew Talks to Chefs. I think you may have to be subscribed to do that. I'm not sure if you just have to recently listen to one or not. And then when that opens up, you're going to see a listing of all the episodes. It says My Episodes. And if you slowly, because it needs a moment to load, scroll to the bottom of the episode listing till you get all the way down to number episode one, will be at the bottom. You will then see bolded ratings and reviews. And you will see five purple stars. You can tap on the number of stars you want to rate the show. And you will see under those stars, one review will show. And under that one review, you will see a little icon of a pen inside a box, and it says write a review. And that is how you write a review. You're making quizzical.
I don't know. Well, those instructions were great. I just don't understand why they're making it so difficult for people to
write. Why it's not just right there on every episode.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Hmm. So again, you go to Library, Shows, pick the show.
Scroll to the
bottom. Slowly scroll down to the end of the episode listings. There you will see the five purple stars, and you can tap on the number you want to give. The answer to that, by the way, is five. I'm just kidding. Not really. And then below the one review showing is a little icon of a pen in a box, and that's how you write a review. So now, if you've wanted to review the show mm-hmm. and didn't know how to go about it, that's how you go about it.
Yeah, and I mean, those are good instructions.
Thank you. I'm going to try to do a clean, you know me, I'm a perfectionist. I'm going to do a graphic representation and throw it up on Facebook and Instagram at some point. But it involves taking like a bunch of screen grabs and making them pretty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe not today.
No. Got too much work to do. In any event, that's all I'm going to say in this mid-show break. But I did want to tell people that because I heard that and I thought, oh, gosh, I wonder how many people have been frustrated
by that.
Yeah, because I haven't written a review in a long time myself. I will remind people, if you want to subscribe to the show, please do that at Stitcher or iTunes. And if you want to follow us on social media, the best place to do that is Instagram. The handle is @ChefPodcast. That's @ChefPodcast. So with that, I'm going to return you to the interview between me and Daniel Holtzman. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. How does this empire that we're sitting in right now, how do we get from this background and these jobs that you're describing to the inception of what is now a very successful group of restaurants?
I worked in a couple of restaurants in California that were, you know, not as fancy.
Yeah. In Northern California.
Mm-hmm. And I opened a restaurant up in San Francisco and then...
As the chef
and kind of like part owner. And that was a really great experience because I got to watch, you know, as a small percentage owner, the... opening of the restaurant, and I saw the intricacies of writing the business plan and raising money uh-huh. and real estate and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
So I got to kind of like learn that process. And then I putzed around for a couple of years working at other restaurants, and I had already transitioned into, you know, I'd already, I guess the jump is I got a job as a chef at a
kind of like a cafe in Venice, California.
Uh-huh.
And it was really a cook's job. I got a job as a cook, and they gave me a promotion. That was the first job that I didn't really give a shit about, or I didn't feel very passionately about. And it was the first time I really excelled politically. And it was because I had a lack of, you know, passion that, you know, I didn't care, I was probably a friendly, nice person. I wasn't trying to be better than anybody. Well, I wasn't trying to do anything. I didn't like... Does that make sense?
It does, but also, tell me if I'm wrong. When you say, you know, going from the level of jobs and experience you're talking about to just a job as a cook in Venice, California,
mm-hmm.
to me that implies that you were kind of recharging, half dropping out for a little bit. The job was really just to make some money, and you wanted to kind of be at the beach and sort of think.
I just didn't care.
You weren't that heavily. There to like pick up new skills, like be inspired.
I was just trying to make
some
cash.
You were airing out a little bit, yeah.
And so that, and I was like, after three weeks, they offered me, they were like, you should be the chef of this restaurant. I was like, real weird. So, and then I got another chef job for money. And at the Inn of the Seventh Ray, which is a really great, old, funny restaurant in Topanga Canyon in L.A., which has been there for like 30 years and it's run by this amazing hippie woman who... It was kind of like the Southern California equivalent. If she wasn't so crazy, she'd be like the Alice Waters of...
Yeah.
Not that Alice Waters is like 100% sane, but she would... She's pretty amazing and crazy and awesome.
Yeah.
And I worked there for a year, and then it was like, okay, I was best friends with this guy named Nate Appleman at the time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And he was up in San Francisco, and we were going to open a restaurant.
A16.
We're going to open this restaurant together up there. So I moved up to back up to Northern California to open this restaurant with him. And so I kind of like was in this realm of being a chef now and having like a chef job and running a kitchen and learning how to do that, and had transitioned into making more kind of rustic food from the fancier French food, and kind of fallen in love a little bit with Italian food and spent some time in Italy and done some research doing, you know, with that.
Where in Italy?
A lot of time in Southern Italy, not a lot of time in Northern Italy, like Rome and Lazio and, you know, the Marche and, you know, kind of like that that south central.
Were you working over there or just
no,
eating around?
No, just eating a lot. Going back and forth and eating a lot. Eating a lot. I ate a lot. I got really lucky and got to go on a bunch of great trips there.
That's great.
It was awesome. So then it was like I was in Southern California and I was working. I was just kind of working. I don't even remember where I was working.
Yeah.
And Mike Chernow, who was my partner at the meatball shop, called me up and was like, you know, he'd been calling me talking about opening a restaurant. We had gone to high school together. And actually, he was a delivery boy with me at the Candle Cafe.
Is that right?
Like we'd worked as delivery boys
together.
Hollywood
ending. Yeah.
And so he called me up asking me to open a restaurant for years and years. And finally, he was like, listen, I'm going to do this. And I flew back to open a restaurant with him.
Did he have the concept?
We were going to open a, like a, What's the restaurant in Barcelona? Cal Pep? It's like a tapas bar.
Yeah.
There's no menu.
Yeah.
They just kind of tell you what you're going to order and eat. And it's a big bar. And it was going to be something like that, a little bit more fancy. And we had a really hard time finding a restaurant location with just because real estate and whatnot and first-time restaurants. And so the concept came of really both of us coming to terms with what we really wanted out of the experience of opening a restaurant. Because the restaurant he had in his mind was a little bit more chef-driven.
Yeah.
And the restaurant that I had in my mind was, I don't want a restaurant that is going to require me to stand at the kitchen, you know, without, otherwise the quality is going to, you know, diminish. Ultimately, the restaurant that we got was different than either one of us.
How
necessarily.
So?
Well, I imagined when we were having the original conversations about the meatball shop that it wouldn't be critically appreciated at all. You know, that I was like, listen, I'm going to make some money, hopefully
have a lifestyle
and, you know, I believe we're doing something that will serve a purpose, but I think people are going to kind of laugh at us from a culinary perspective, and that's okay. I'm like willing to not be on the cover of some magazine in exchange for, you know, having a life. And so I think I kind of got my cake and ate it too. But on the other side of that, the quality does require a level of culinary oversight. Because I don't know how to...
Culinary, what did you say?
Like
oversight
yeah. You know, and I don't really know how to open a shitty chain restaurant.
Right.
Like, that was my dream, was like, I'm going to open a shitty chain restaurant. It's going to be amazing. We're like, serve these frozen meatballs, and then I'm going to be rich.
You blew
and
it. You opened a good it. Restaurant.
I think it's like not a joke. It's a joke, but it's like not a joke, because I was like, damn it. Like, the whole, you know... I remember having these conversations with Daniel Sharp, who's a kind of executive chef at the Meatball Shop, and he's my, you know, really dear friend.
Yeah.
And we, you know, just having these conversations, like, if it was just a little bit worse, you know, it would be so much easier.
Yeah.
Because we can't hire, when we open a restaurant, we need to find a chef to run the kitchen. It's like, we can't just have, like, kitchen manager.
Like a glorified cook.
Yeah, because then the whole chain, and as I've learned more and more about it, like the whole entire distribution system and chain restaurants in America are all built on these, like, you know, idea that you have these like frozen products that you just kind of like
It's rip. Based on brainless cooking.
Yeah. And so we, at times we've tried to, you know, idiot-proof the system, and then ultimately it just gets worse and worse and worse. What invariably happens is when you make a job mindless, you end up attracting mindless employees, right?
Yeah.
And so as you kind of make it easier, you get, you know, you degrade the quality of the folks that want to work in that environment. Like if you gave me a job and you were like, you know, your job is to figure out how to bring these pile of rocks over here and organize them over here in an interesting way, I'm like, that might attract me to do that job. And I'm like an intelligent person interested. If you're like, the job is, you know, pick this rock up here, put it down over here, it's mindless, then all of a sudden it attracts a mindless worker. And then all of a sudden, so it's like the stupider, the dumber, or the more idiot proof you make the system, the more idiots you get, and then the worse off you are. And it's like this cycle of diminishing returns.
Yeah, but what's
degradation.
What's so interesting to me about what you're describing is that you... I mean, this seems to me like an amazing situation you created for yourself. You created something that is right. Right in your personal, professional matrix of happiness, right? Like, the food's pitched right where you wanted it to be. You've afforded yourself the life you wanted, and you guys have been crazy successful.
Yeah, and that. But I'm completely, just like every other neurotic crazy person, you know. Unhappy? Not unhappy.
Restless?
But restless, yeah. I'm not unhappy at all.
How are
you restless, though? I don't know, but you asked it when we were upstairs, you said, you know, do you cook at home? And I'm like, I cook at home a lot.
What do you cook at home? Do you lean back? Do you go back to the stuff you came up like
a train? I cook a lot of Asian food.
Do you?
Because the Meatball Shop is a mix and match menu. It doesn't really lend itself to Eastern flavors so much.
Right.
You know, because it would be weird if you like, you know, have a dish made with sesame oil and then you try and mix that with like, you know, Parmesan cream sauce and like Parmesan cheese. It would be kind of not great. So I cook a lot of Indian food and a lot of Japanese food and Chinese food and Vietnamese food at home. And I do some French food. I cook some French food.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I cook a lot at home.
What do you, when you go to other people's restaurants, what kind of food do you eat?
If it's a restaurant where I am friends with the chef, and I know he's terrible, I'll eat the roast chicken. Or the, like my friend, if you're,
you can't do it now.
If you're a chef, if you're a chef and you're going out with a chef friend and you know that you're eating at a restaurant, like a Disciples restaurant, or someone's like restaurant that's like just shitty and you know it's shitty, but you're friends with them, you like argue over who's going to get the chicken and who's going to get the burger, because those are the two safest
bets.
See,
I will not order a burger at a friend's restaurant.
Yeah. Well, that's like, you know.
I will. I'll order it to share, but I feel like you can't do that.
You know, like no one get the crispy pork belly. That's always a disaster.
This is like Jacques Pepin used to always say, if he stayed in a hotel, he always ordered the turkey club.
The turkey club.
Yeah, because that was safe.
It's
like
a safe
you could
bet.
Get that anywhere.
I don't know. I eat out. In the last 6 months, I've been eating out a lot less.
Uh-huh.
But I eat out a good amount. I mean, I eat a lot of restaurants, and there's so many great restaurants.
Yeah.
I was just out in L.A.
Oh,
the
well,
L.A. food and dining scene
heaven.
Is amazing.
That's
right
heaven.
Now. And for my whole life, L.A. was this like food wasteland, supposedly. Although that's what's so weird is that everybody said that, but like it has always had the best Japanese food, best Thai food, best Chinese food. Like,
I also feel like LA has always been stigmatized by being the home of Hollywood,
the media was always in New York and a little bit in San Francisco. I feel like people have heard me say this on the people who listen regularly, but I feel like LA has always been, not now,
a great food town.
The most underrated food city in America. I feel like it's been dissed forever. Wolfgang Puck, to me, is strangely an underrated chef. Because all anyone thinks about with him is all the restaurants and the frozen pizzas and the home shopping network. This guy trained in Michelin-starred restaurants and can do anything. Yeah, you know, he opened Spago and then turned on a dime and did a Chinese restaurant.
And Spago is still great.
And Spago's still great.
And Spago did 800. Eric actually told me, you know, he was like, you should go work at Spago. And he was like, you should go work at Spago because there's no restaurant in the world that's doing 800 covers a night at that quality level. And that would be, you know, to learn how to produce quality at that
volume
would be extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah, but the other thing to me, you know, when I was writing my book, I interviewed a guy named Don Salk, who was one of the big investors. You know, there were like 26 dentists and doctors who invested in the original Spago, and Don Salk was the main one. And he said, meet me at the California Pizza Kitchen.
Yeah.
I forget what neighborhood in L.A., maybe around, it was near USC. And we go, and I'm like, why does this guy want to meet at the California Pizza Kitchen?
Like, because I own it.
No, he wanted to show me the influence of Wolfgang Puck. Because the California Pizza Kitchen is Spago for the masses.
Yeah.
Right? It's pizzas and salads and pasta. I mean, that's what Spago did to cuisine. Anyway, I feel like that city's been dissed forever. I just feel like there's always been good, interesting, exciting food there. And now, finally,
it's recognized.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And there's great food. And
it's hard to, if you could go there for a week and agonize over where to eat. I mean, there's so many places you won't get to.
If you are an inspired chef, the farmer's market on Santa Monica on Wednesday.
It's great.
It's just like the best farmer's market in the world.
It's amazing.
It rivals the Paris, and it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like you can hear the surf if you listen hard enough. Like, it's right there.
It's pretty great.
So what's the thing about the, you know, people who haven't been to the meatball shop, right? You hear the name, the meatball shop.
The meatball shop.
But what do you think, what do you want people to know about the meatball
Under-promise and over-deliver.
You know? I was getting ready to come talk. You guys are proud of your sourcing. I mean, it's not
the.
It's more that it's definitely more than the name would suggest.
The original goal of the meatball shop was to open a restaurant that has the same quality of cooking and the same ingredients as the fancier restaurants, but by choosing the menu items that are inherently less expensive, make it accessible and make it, you know, affordable. And then by driving volume through lower prices and, you know, tables that are a little closer together, you could afford to, you know, make money while keeping your prices low.
Yeah.
And, you know, then there was this other kind of like loftier goal. And it's changed now in the world because this is more common now. But at the time, you know, you could work as in a restaurant. There were great restaurants that were shitty places to work, and there were shitty restaurants that were great places to work. Our idea was we were going to have a great restaurant that was a great place to work, meaning, you know, fun, and that there. I feel like restaurants were always built on this exploitive system where it was like someone was getting screwed. It's either like the purveyors or the cooks or the customers or. And our idea was,
100%.
You know, community, purveyors, employees, investors, everybody would win and it would be treated well. And now it's a new paradigm, right? Like that's pretty much where you have to at least say you're trying to be if you want to be respected in the world. Yeah. But at the time that was something
that's a hard talk to walk though.
It's a hard talk to walk.
That's
and it's
much
a hard balance.
Easier said than done.
And so, you know, ultimately, like, we're not like limousine liberals over here, but on some level, because it's working, it's pretty easy for us to continue to maintain that. You know, it's easy for me to say like, well, you know, I spend more money for great ingredients because it's worth it. And the customers, well, if I didn't have the customers, you know, if I was faced with the difficult decision of saying I have to close my restaurant or I have to serve shitty vegetables, I don't know whether I would be able to maintain my like moral, you know, ground. I would probably be like, well, fuck it. I'm going to use some shitty vegetables. But in this particular case, we've been lucky that it has worked and I haven't had to make those kind of hard decisions.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It totally makes sense. But you're talking about this you know, this confluence of decisions and pricing. You know, Mary Sue Milliken, speaking of LA, was on the show recently, and we were talking about, you know, the dirty little secret of the restaurant business is that traditionally there have been either, you know, externs who are working for no money or young cooks who are so hungry for knowledge they're working for almost nothing or nothing. And like, that's always been a part of the business model of the restaurant business. But that's the thing that's you're making agonized faces.
Yeah, because I'm fucking really frustrated and upset about, and maybe it'll work itself out. But I think that, you know, the entire restaurant business was built on this model of internship, right?
Yeah.
We talked about it
yes.
at the beginning, the apprenticeship.
Apprentice, stage, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
And, you know, there is a benefit to the apprentice
yes.
when learning a craft of apprenticeship. And we can't have that apprenticeship anymore based on labor laws and you know, that to me is a lose-lose for the business and the apprentices.
Well, you are saying publicly right now what most chefs I know, whether or not they will acknowledge it in an interview, and what I personally believe, that there is something in it for the apprentice.
There's
that,
that 100%.
Yeah. I mean, I came up in the film business and I interned, you know, in the summers. I mean, I was lucky in that I could afford to do it. But I worked for Universal Studios one summer. I didn't make any money. I went in every day.
The thing is that
I learned a ton and I met people who hired me.
Jacques Pepin, I watched him at the Mad Symposium. I was out there in Copenhagen and he like did this talk about learning a craft, and it was really expressed it better than I ever could, which is it takes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours to become, you know,
proficient
at a craft. And that those hours, you know, if like it, I would I'm really good at peeling carrots. I'm a competitive person, so I'm competing with myself and everybody around me to be the fastest, peeler. But it's taken me like, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds of carrots peeling to get good at it. And I can't afford to pay somebody $14 an hour to peel carrots and learn how to peel carrots well. And so, you know, maybe there are a few people that are going home and learning and grabbing a bag of carrots and doing it on their own. I certainly in my past have, you know, told people, hey, grab a bag of onions and bring them home and peel them and learn your knife skills. But I can't afford to pay a cook to do that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I have to find people that are already able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I give people a knife skills test as part of the, you know, as part of the interview process.
Yeah.
Because I can't afford to pay people
yes.
minimum wage even to,
yeah.
To learn knife skills, like not on my dime.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. That's a real shame. That's a shame, you know. And the reality is that I get the fact that we are in a rush to be, you know, to make money. And I completely get it. Like, the millennial attitude makes perfect sense. I don't think it's a negative thing. I think it's a factor of, like, the confluence of education, information, and communication. You know, the internet has made it so that, you know, my friend was the other day, a young person saying, like, why would I want to do that job? I'm going to make minimum wage. I should just skip that step. It's like, it's not worth it. You know, I'm going to make $200 a week. It doesn't mean anything. The answer is like, you're right. That couple hundred bucks doesn't make sense. You're not working for the couple hundred bucks. You're working for the the experience and the base to give yourself. And so for me, I'm like, Eric told me, don't take a sous chef job, work for $10 an hour for 10 years, and then, you know, have the expertise to get the job that makes you a lot of money.
And that you'll have for the rest of your life.
And you'll have for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Right.
And that is what's missing, and it's a damn shame. And it's maybe there'll be a different way around it, but I think that the next generation of cooks, you know, they're going to have to figure out how to learn it on their own.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. It's a shame, shame, shame. I'm very nervous for, I'm not nervous for me. And people are like, it's so hard to find people. It's like, it's all just a challenge and the challenge is always changing. I'm nervous for, you know, the culinary community and
the next
food
in
20 years.
Yeah. It's so funny. We've never talked before, but what you just said is very much my view of the whole thing. Things are okay. You know, things are fine right now. I do feel like things have become strangely stratified. Like, I feel like there's a population of cooks who are still kind of putting in the time and the kind of way you're describing it. And then I feel like there's people who are just in a mad dash, you know? And I feel like it's very separate. And I do wonder how it's all going to shake out, you know? But at some point the market will determine it. There'll be a need to get, there's going to be a need for the knowledge, and somehow people are going to, whether they retroactively do it or, I don't know.
I think the trend alert 2020 is that cooking is falling out of fashion, and restaurants and cooking, and it's the end of a trend.
Cooking?
Not just in general. I think like the sexy chef thing was really, is amazing. I'm very lucky to have had a chance to ride a bit of the ride. But I wonder if there's something next on the trend.
Well, I'll tell you, I did a panel thing recently, and Eric Bromberg from Blue Ribbon was on the panel, with his brother Bruce, one of the two founders of Blue Ribbon Restaurants. And he said something no one had ever said, at least to me. I was moderating. Automation.
Yeah.
He said automation in kitchens is inevitable.
Oh, yeah.
You believe that?
So not only do I believe it, but...
When
you turn off the microphone, I'm going to show you my new burger vending machine, which is extraordinary. Japan is the wave of the future. I think so. I think so. Yeah, I mean, there was just an article in the New York Times about the first fully automated restaurant opening in San Francisco, which Danielle Balut is uh-huh. Consulting on the project and helping them from MIT or whatever.
All right.
Stanford.
This definitely puts a limit on this podcast, but.
No, I mean, obviously.
It'll be like Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
You can automate creativity or anything else, but probably there's still going to be room for some human influence.
Yes, I'm sure.
I hope.
Okay, well, on that optimistic note, you got a plane to catch. Great talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah, that was a pleasure.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Caitlin, thank you.
My pleasure, Andrew.
You have to take a slightly later train. Did we blow it?
We blew it, but that's okay. I'll take the slightly later train.
We got to do these at night.
I just want to do it also before it rains.
We got to do these at night. The truth is, I grilled last night.
And made very strong
margaritas. And we fell asleep watching television.
Yeah, and you know what? I was drinking it.
And then I had that crazy dream.
I know, but I was
that I'm still trying
it.
To shake off.
It was strong, and you didn't believe me. And then I look over, and you were passed out.
Well, you know what it is? I can sip wine.
Yeah.
Cocktails that have, like, lime juice or lemon juice.
Yeah.
I used to know this, and I remember the first drink I ever had. My father, who used to let me drink when I was really underage at home, you know, he was like, sip it. But
he didn't last night.
I just stopped sipping drinks recently. I've told people, I think I have a little bit of a drinking thing going on because I drink too fast.
Yeah, you do.
And I'm a lightweight. That's the biggest issue. I mean, I had one
drink. It's a funny combination, Andrew.
Yes, exactly. I want to live that, like, you know, right. That writer, that, like, barfly writer existence.
Well, no, you don't, because those are alcoholics, but...
Right. Anyway, Daniel Holtzman, thank you. Thank you for your honesty. I really mean it. That was amazing. Love that interview. And David Tatasciore, as always, thank you for splicing these things together. You're my favorite engineer in the world. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening, and we'll see you back next week, if not sooner, on Andrew Talks to Chefs.